Hi everyone, welcome to another of our virtual ILS Asia 2021 event broadcasts. Please do visit the event website to see the details of our kind sponsors without who we couldn't put on this event, as well as to view all of our agenda and the video content from the conference, which you'll be able to view on demand after every session has been initially aired. So we're continuing to update you on ILS activity and opportunities with a particular focus on the Asia region, of course, and one eye to the future, as is our way. And this year we focus on our theme of expanding market access and opportunities. And for this particular broadcast, we're going to be focusing on the ILS investor landscape across the Asia region. And I'm delighted to have Timothy Yip, Executive Director at Hong Kong-based HSZ Group and the only existing ILS investment manager in Asia, ILS Advisors, with me. Thanks for joining me today, Tim.
Oh, thank you, Steve. We're delighted to be here and to participate.
Great to have you with us. So, as I said, we're going to be exploring the investor landscape in Asia, specifically, obviously, for insurance and securities. And there's some very long-standing relationships in the ILS market with investors in this region, some locations much deeper sort of engagement with ILS than others. But largely, there's still a lot of untapped capital, a lot of untapped institutions in the region. And ILS advisors are particularly well positioned to understand this area of the world and what its investors are looking for, given that that's been your business model. So, Tim, to begin, perhaps for the benefit of our viewers, you could explain a little bit about the history and maturity of ILS in Asia as an investment class.
Okay. Yeah, no, sure, Steve. I guess perhaps starting with just Asia-based sponsors. I mean, the Japanese have been issuing cat bonds pretty much since the beginning, I think starting around sort of the mid-late 90s, and probably a few years into it, I guess. Pretty much all the large Japanese P&C insurers have and continue to issue cat bonds quite consistently. 2003, we saw sort of the Taiwanese residential earthquake pool sponsored from Formosa Re, cat bond covering Taiwanese earthquake. In 15, China Re in Beijing sponsored Panda Re. That was covering mainland Chinese earthquakes. 2019 is sort of a landmark year, I think, for ILS in Asia. Started initially with our friends down the road at Peak Re. I think they offered their first vintage of their sidecar in January of that year, which was sort of the first sidecar offering via Asian-based reinsurer. A month later, IHE sponsored Orchard Re, covering Australia and New Zealand catastrophe risks, and was also the first cat bond issued out of Singapore. And I guess the year ended with the Philippines and then the World Bank getting together really to issue a cat bond responding to Philippines earthquakes and typhoons. And of course, sort of earlier this year in 2021, MSM Lin's Asia Pacific operations in Singapore sponsored Phoenix One, which we were fortunate enough to work with them with as sort of the first Pan-Asia catastrophe bond offering, which also was nicely issued out of Singapore and supported quite significantly, almost half of investors with some sort of link to Asia Pacific. In terms of investors, I think Japan really began investing with significance probably around 2010, from what I know. We here at HSZ Group, we started our ILS Advisors division, which we believe was the first dedicated Asia-based ILS manager in 2012. South Korea, I think they began looking at it probably, 2013, 14, but then sort of investing significantly probably around 2016. Of course, unfortunately, the timing was just before the events of 2017. And then in terms of, Singapore as an ILS domicile issued their first cat bond in 2019. Since then, I think they've issued, I think it's 17 at last count. The number keeps growing quite quickly. It's quite impressive. And it's probably the second most popular cat bond issuing domicile in the world right now. And then here in Hong Kong, And I recently just launched this year their own sort of ILS regulatory regime, really focused primarily around the Greater China area. And this morning, I guess, maybe it's by the time recording, it's a week later, but the Greater Bay Relimited was registered, which looks like China Re will be issuing their second cat bond, but this time via Hong Kong.
Yeah, so it's good to see the activity picking up and good to see Hong Kong entering the fray as well. So you mentioned Japan there and obviously South Korea. Now, they're definitely two of the locations where we see pensions allocating to ILS. And I suppose Singapore has sovereign wealth investors as well. But why do you think those locations have been the first to embrace ILS as an asset class in the region?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two. I mean, the two biggest reasons is just the institutional market size in say Japan, or maybe if you widen it to Asia Pacific, like Australia, they're just so much bigger, right? And then they're also a lot more pooling of assets there. I mean, the assets under management for pension funds in Japan and Australia combined is more than the total of the rest of Asia combined, right? So just that sort of size is and scale is huge. And, you know, Australia has like what, the fourth largest pension assets in the world, despite a population that's less than some single cities in mainland China, right? Mm. And so even if you take out, you know, mainland China, which is, you know, has, you know, different barriers to entry, you know, that difference between, say, you know, Japan, Australia, plus maybe South Korea, and like you said, maybe to 2 degrees Singapore, is quite drastic. It's quite a big difference. You know, all those sort of regions that you mentioned, you know, persistent low interest environment are persist there. Combined with, you know, sort of limited domestic growth, it sort of creates a lot of pressure, I think, on investors to meet return targets. You know, government bond spreads in Japan are probably similar to what you see in Europe, low, sometimes negative. You know, you compare that with, you know, a developing country like Malaysia, Philippines. I wouldn't say mainland China is developing, but it's still somewhere maybe in between. Or, you know, are in excess of 3.5%. India is like 5.5-6% ballpark. It's a big difference. They're definitely more mature markets, the ones that are already existing. I think this allows them to sort of develop a much more larger and more visible and accessible concentration of institutional investors, family offices, you know, international private bank presence, and sort of the typical investors that would view ILS more favorably. There's, you know, over this time, there's more infrastructure there to reach them. You know, finding partners within the countries for marketing distribution purposes is more established. It's more transparent. It's just more accessible, right? In contrast, you know, the mainland China has, you know, very well known barriers to entry compared to say South Korea. You know, places like Taiwan, for example, you know, it should be somewhere that, you know, it has the characteristics that you would think would be attracted to the asset class, right? You know, it's large, you know, institutional investors there, you know, appetite for foreign, you know, especially US denominated instruments. You know, they have a lot more barriers to entry for this product, you know, compared to, say, Japan, South Korea, Australia. South Korea, you know, they have looked at it, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, they've gone through, you know, a very visible or a very strategic multi-year effort to diversify their portfolios and reduce volatility. Therefore, they've increased allocations across, you know, almost any different way you can sort of diversify, whether it be geography, asset class, industry, and so. So that sort of lends itself well, obviously, to an asset class like ILS. And I think it's, you know, it's also just the practicality of it all. You know, for say you're a private ILS manager, your strategy is a little bit more complex than say a catastrophe bond focused funds. You know, realistically, you need somebody there directly meeting the clients or the investors, trying to explain it. Asia is just, it's just a massive region, right? And it's also a very far, far away region for most managers. You know, if you're in Bermuda, I don't even know which way is faster to get here, you know, whether via Europe or, you know, through over, you know, North America. Either way, it's really, really far, right? But, you know, even when you get here, it's really far. You know, like a flight from just Sydney to Singapore, it seems a lot closer than it is. It's about 8 hours, right? And then so just from Singapore to Tokyo is another 7 hours. And so, you know, if you're that ILS manager and you're trying to make that marketing trip to Asia, right? That I don't know, once or twice a year trip, or you know, you can only practically see so many cities. And so I guess you sort of focus on where the best chances are. And so, you know, Australia, Japan, say Korea, over the years, they've all, you know, they probably all learned and they've gone through that education process already. You know, other ILS managers have probably gone there before. You know, there's movement, of course, within ILS funds, and, you know, they take their Rolodexes with them. And so you can just be more efficient just by going to these sort of markets, and, you know, you can fast track and jump to track record, jump to your strategy and differentiation instead of trying to explain what the asset class is and those sort of things. Mm. Yeah, and so it's also, I mean, it's a very fragmented region in every possible way you can measure diversity and fragmentation, language, cultural differences. You know, many of them are, it's not known how to, you know, the rules between entering the market, whether you need a local partner or just a way to find these investors. And I think a lot of these more developing regions, less established regions, they still have quite a significant sort of home bias. You know, they just focus a lot more on domestic opportunities. You know, the domestic opportunities have probably served them quite well because it's, you know, they're sort of in that phase. You know, currency risk is probably, you know, significant, and hedging costs. And yeah, so just the diversity, you know, Sydney to Shanghai, the difference is slightly different than, you know, New York to Toronto, right? So, yeah. So I think, absolutely, you know, the biggest driver anyways, in the end of the day, is just, you know, institutional size and just the pooling of assets in those countries.
Yeah. No, it's interesting that you mentioned in developing regions where sort of the baseline rates are so much higher than we're typically used to in Europe or in the US. And when you think about the returns of a cat bond fund strategy that's managed out of Europe, perhaps, that's really probably not going to seem like an asset class that somebody in Malaysia, for example, really wants to put the effort into learning.
It's tough. Yeah.
Challenging to think how they would view a risk asset class where they can go to zero essentially in the assets they hold at the returns, which maybe suggests we need an ILS market floating on top of regional rates in Asia to really get that broader interest as well. In future.
Yeah, it could work.
So if we think about the types of investors, obviously you mentioned pensions, and they're typically the biggest allocator in most countries in the world. Do you think that's the same in Asia, and is that destined to be the same, or might we see a slightly different mix emerging there?
Yeah, no, I mean, I mentioned before, I guess, Japan and Australia and New Zealand and Korea, I think there's, you know, they've all been significant sort of allocators towards the asset class already. However, you know, there's, you know, Japanese pensions, we have noticed, you know, it's quite a big transition over the past few years. They used to be probably the most conservative in the region, I would say. And now they've gone a bit more, quite a heavy sort of like equity heavy allocation relative to before. I mean, before it was only about 30%. Now it's moved up to 40, 45, and they've now reduced, you know, the fixed income is reduced from 60 to about 40, 45. So now it's about split between. Also, you know, the timing of some of the investors in Japan, you know, is probably mixed at best. And so their view could be mixed. I think given the hedging costs, I suspect many went into perhaps the more private ILS strategies, which obviously in the last few years haven't performed as well in many cases. I think there's other sort of markets in Asia, there are opportunities. However, it is very different region to region. They all have sort of different sort of roadblocks, I guess, but the scale also may not be so attractive. But on the positive, I guess we do see quite obviously there's a sort of a increase in investments in foreign assets pretty much across the board. However, I think, you know, especially in something like fixed income, which is a lot of the times the department we're sort of sent to when we go speak to them, there's quite a significant home bias still. Much of this, like we were mentioned before, can be explained due to, you know, higher local interest rates, currency volatility in some markets, maybe quite a high cost of hedging, maybe potentially there. But, you know, here in Hong Kong, there's sort of other issues. You know, we wouldn't have that sort of currency risk. You know, our Hong Kong dollars pegged to the US dollar are, you know, we have comparable, even slightly lower government yield spreads than say the US or Canada. It's also a global financial center with a sort of experienced and sophisticated investor community. However, you know, our pension sort of system is very much dominated by what we call MPF. It's similar to like a sort of a 401k type of mandatory contribution scheme, but it's very individual choice type of scheme, not pooled, which is not too dissimilar to sort of a lot of the more developing countries that, you know, the pension schemes are more recent or have had sort of significant reform more recently. So for example, in Hong Kong, you know, we're also a very low income tax country, right? So our contributions are very minimal. Almost everyone invests the minimal amount. And also, like, we just aren't allowed to have those products available to us. So like, in, for example, like I said, in Hong Kong, the allocation to alternatives is zero, right? It's just, right. It's not a permissible investment. You know, Hong Kong property, as you know, is the most expensive in the world. So essentially, you know, residential property ownership is more of the primary sort of savings mechanism for or wealth accumulator for retirement for most residents. You know, work to pay off your home and maybe sell your home and immigrate to Canada or Australia. I don't know. Yeah, so I mean, we do see overall some sort of positive trends. Like I said, foreign investment assets are rising. The size of these regions, just the assets they have available to invest, is increasing. And they are looking more towards, we do see many of them looking more towards alternatives and looking for sort of alpha generation potential and portfolio diversification. But also, you know, a lot of the pension funds here, you know, whether it be Japan, Korea, you know, the emerging sort of countries, they are considering more of the sort of global trends that you'll see probably in Europe and North America as well. So things like, you know, ESG considerations. And so, you know, to the degree where investors view ILS as an asset class sort of consistent with ESG principles, I guess that's a positive sign out here. Overall, though, I think, you know, what will really drive sort of new investors from the sort of institutions out here, it's just experience, I think, in the years coming ahead. I think there's a lot of sort of, you know, we're interested in it. Let's have a sort of we'd like to sort of take a wait and see approach, see things sort of turn around. Probably not too dissimilar than, you know, what we saw out here in 2011. After 2011, you know, we want to see a few years, which unfortunately meant a lot of them came in 2015-16. But, you know, if you're a strategy, like if you're, you know, you have a strategy that largely avoided losses after 2017, you missed maybe some of the losses from 18 and 19, then maybe there is some sort of opportunity now. And so, you know, a lot of the investors are new to this. They're still, you know, they still link it back to climate change. And so I think they basically, if you really need to show the track record, it's even more important just to sort of prove that, you know, there's still sort of a return to be made, and that it's sort of inbuilt within the strategy.
Yeah. No, that's really important. People do need to be able to demonstrate the excess return they can generate, I think, over the long run. No, it's interesting what you mentioned about the time lag as well with certain pensions. I can remember visiting Tokyo in about 2008, and I met with a financial group out there, and they'd just started to explore catastrophe bonds. And I think they eventually allocated in about 2018. It took 10 years of education, and while they were getting up to speed and educating their trustee board members, that sort of thing, and the company itself that owned the pension. But it's also quite diverse in terms of risk appetite, it seems to me, out there. There's pensions where ILS will be an extremely small proportion, like 0.1% of their allocations. And then there was one Japanese camera manufacturer that had something like 8% of its pension fund in ILS at one point a few years ago. So really diverse mix of strategies, it seems. But I guess on other types of investors that you might see in the region, I suppose are family offices and high net worth individuals allocating to ILS, do you feel?
I don't think there's not a lot of investment per se. There's some, like some of our investors are you know, regional family offices or linked to sort of high net worth individuals. But I think maybe interest and curiosity has definitely sort of increased. I think here, you know, if you talk about family offices, we're talking, you know, really Hong Kong and Singapore. They're two sort of big family office hubs. Here in Hong Kong in recent years, you know, there's a bit more volatility or perhaps some reduced confidence in more traditional sectors like, you know, local real estate, right? And perhaps some degree of volatility in the confidence of the city overall, given the sort of events of the past maybe 2-3 years. So I think that's sort of created a sort of interest, at least into looking at sort of, you know, asset classes or alternative asset classes, and sort of away from sort of domestic opportunities, maybe a little bit of a flight to safety. So we have seen, you know, recent interest in sort of new and niche products, you know, from distribution people and stuff trying to sell something new to their clients. Especially in Hong Kong and Singapore, really. Both cities also have, you know, their significant sort of private banking presences. You know, international private banks all pretty much have a presence here in Hong Kong. I think 15 of the top 15 are all in Hong Kong, and so they're probably already, you know, they already have that sort of asset class offering already. So I think because of that, you know, a lot of the family offices probably looked at more of the traditional catastrophe bond offerings, just because of, you know, these family offices aren't easy to access.
Sure.
And so, you know, a lot of them are, you know, a lot of the cat bond funds, maybe they're linked with that type of distribution that has the ability to, you know, it's easier to explain, and you may not need that manager coming out here and trying to access that. I think on sort of more, maybe the more pessimistic side, I think the wealth here in Asia is a bit newer overall than we would see in, say, Europe, especially. I think over something like 70% of all family offices in Hong Kong are, you know, it's within past 2000. Only about, I think it's 5 or 10% has been before, like even the 1970s. You know, a lot of the growth is new. It's still generation one, and a lot of the growth in the family offices are really sort of driven out of the opportunities that were linked to sort of the mainland and domestically. And I think a lot of times, you know, generation one, they're still involved since it's reasonably newer. And then, you know, we tend to find that they like to stick within their own industries for the most part. Stuff that they feel more comfortable with, something they can, you know, leverage their own sort of link to their own existing business. They're less comfortable with going outside and seeing new sort of things they don't understand. Of course, it's Hong Kong. A lot of them still very, you know, they love real estate. And so sort of, you know, that sort of comfort or safety in investing in something they feel they understand, something a bit more tangible to them, they can get their head around, still exceeds, I think, the perceived safety or comfort you can get from, you know, like an ultra diversified portfolio.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it does seem that quite a lot of money in Asia will get reinvested into infrastructure or related businesses, as you said, which
I think it's changing a bit. Like, so, you know, like it's been 30, it's about 30 years, right? Of sort of consistent growth between, you know, Hong Kong's, maybe it's a little bit earlier first, and then, but it's always linked to the mainland. But because of that, we're sort of entering generation two, I think. Like, there's, you can sort of feel that sort of transitioning sort of really happening. You know, generation two is really different, right? So that group, especially here, especially I think in this region, the sort of Hong Kong, mainland China region, you know, generation two from the mainland, you know, typically they're no siblings. They've only grown up during the sort of rise of the country. They're very, you know, highly educated, often spending a lot of time abroad, international schools or university, and they've gained a lot of experience in the West, as opposed to their parents, right? The mentality is quite a bit different. They've gone through, you know, a lot more difficult times in the past. So I think that sort of changing of the guard, I guess, you know, is affecting, and we see it, you know, investor appetites. We see this sort of newer generation, they certainly have a more optimistic view, more willingness to take a risk and less fear of seeing the sort of the wealth go away as fast as it's sort of accumulated. They have a lot less attachment to their industries linked to the original family business, since, you know, they probably weren't really involved, right? It's, and so I think a lot of their own relationships now are not from the family business or the connections around there. It's likely more from, you know, their time at, I don't know, Oxford or Wharton or something like that, or when they were working, or those few years, you know, in one of the banks in London, New York. So I think that second generation is trying to expand. They're trying to sort of expand the business or where it's generating income. They're much more open to sort of new ideas and diversification and alternatives and those sort of things. And especially with the things like, you know, green fund investments is really big now out here. Investments are sort of that sort of social or charitable benefits. And I think ILS, you know, in providing that sort of post-disaster financing quickly, that kind of angle is likely quite interesting. Impact investing is on the rise here, and it's quite meaningful. And so we could see these type of investors, I think, you know, these family offices as it's sort of transitioning. I think there's, you know, they may lean perhaps more towards a expected higher yielding strategy, like a private ILS strategy, perhaps, if the track record is there, or if there's sort of a compelling strategy, something that sounds, you know, creative and that sort of thing. I think there's some opportunities there with the,
okay, that group. Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. What about on sort of, I guess, one other area that's particularly in Europe, fairly large in ILS or has been in the past, is the multi-strategy investment managers who seem to have allocated to everything in the space, really, from cat bonds right the way through to sort of private strategies. We had some very big multi-strategy funds in the UK that were very exposed to retrocession losses in 2017-18, for example. But do you think in Asia there are sort of multi-strategy managers who might be looking to incorporate ILS as part of their strategies?
Yeah, I think so. Of course, I think just because the asset class offers, obviously, it's very easy to understand non-correlation or independence. There's a very wide range of risk to reward profiles available. So that's sort of a helpful tool. It has different liquidity options and those sort of things. So combined together, I think it can provide a very complementary addition or tool to sort of a multi-strategy investment manager. Again, I think, you know, if there's a few good years of consistent sort of returns, sort of that bounce back or no losses similar to 2017, I think that interest will be there for sure, especially in the more developed regions. Again, with the you know, lower interest rates and you know, pressure to find sort of yield somewhere.
Yeah, okay, interesting. So if we think about the region, obviously one of the areas that people often talk about is China, mainland China, and the potential opportunity there. And now, as you said, we're hoping to see the first cat bond coming directly out of China via Hong Kong soon. But on the capital and investor side, it's obviously a country where assets are building up all the time, and there must be a need to invest that, and the need to diversify internationally is going to happen at some stage. But how well educated do you think the Chinese investor base is on ILS today?
There's definitely sort of room for further education and awareness domestically on the mainland regarding this sort of asset class. We have seen sort of an increase in interest and curiosity, at least with mainland Chinese investors, over, you know, a wide ranging different types of investors, whether it's, you know, institutional or higher net worth or distribution and those sort of things. But I think, you know, why it hasn't been there yet, I guess, I mean, there's language issues, not very clear. I think transparent strategy for entry into the Chinese market sort of prevented it. You know, it's a very, very heavily domestic focused investor community, right? There's not a lot of infrastructure on the mainland, I think, ready to sort of help with those sort of introductions or access. And always the key hurdle is, you know, there's very strict limitations, right? Like for foreign investments, for mainland Chinese investors. And it's not very consistent. Currently, you know, how it works is, like, you know, if you're an institution in China or investor in China, especially a bigger one, you can apply under a sort of a, what they call a QDII program, which is a, you know, qualified domestic institutional investor, which is sort of like credits or quotas, right? So, which are the only real way you can sort of make outbound investments. And so it's relatively limited. It's also very concentrated. And the sort of growth in that quota, it's not very clear. It's not very consistent either. And so I think the total amount, last time I checked, is about 150 billion USD, which are allocated to fund companies, security firms, insurers, and banks. But it's concentrated around just a few, really just the larger ones. Obviously, it's easier to sort of monitor and control that way. It's only about 175 different institutions have successfully applied, which isn't a lot, right? If you think of it, and then obviously it's a very competitive market to be able to get those allocations, and it's a very finite market. And so we see, even internally with these firms, there's a lot of, you know, need to have sort of internal transfer pricing rules in place to trade quotas internally. This increases the sort of cost and complexity of these, you know, securing mandates there. And so it's, you know, I do think, though, like, once that's sort of available, the education process will be quite swift. The demand and scale potential from investors there is obviously quite huge. There's also obviously quite a lot of actual demand for investing in sort of for things outside the sort of domestic market. It's just, you know, it's not available yet. But we are seeing sort of a degree of the central government trying to look to this demand. So I think once it's available, it will be there. And then here in Hong Kong, that's actually, you know, it's quite close to us in terms of importance. And you know, Hong Kong's obviously quite well positioned for that. It's almost its purpose for what it does now. I mean, recently we've seen, just earlier this year, you know, the Hong Kong government and the central government sort of had this, has a scheme called the Greater Bay Area Wealth Management Connect, I think it's called, for example, which basically is there to facilitate outbound and inbound, but both ways, greater cross-border investments. And so it allows for about $50 billion US of fund flow combined, shared northbound and southbound. And so this is, you know, the purpose of it is, I guess half of it is really to allow some mainland Chinese investors to be able to sort of diversify their wealth opportunities outside the domestic opportunities, something they're just previously not able to do. I mean, it's just a start. You know, the southbound scheme allows individuals who reside in, you know, sort of one of the nine mainland cities in the sort of Greater Bay Area. But it's only limited to about 150,000 per person. It doesn't seem like a lot. Again, there's about 70 million people living in the Greater Bay Area. So.
Sure.
It's something they're definitely working on. Being able to sort of, you know, the central government they understand that the demands there. They're trying to figure out a way to be able to allow for it in a controlled way. And then the one I mentioned before that comes off of, we actually have another scheme called Stock Connect and Bond Connect, which is really doing the same thing, allowing for a facility to allow for that sort of the outbound and inbound sort of investment between, you know, investing into mainland China, but also for mainland Chinese to invest outside.
Mm. And what about the kind of investors you might see in China? I mean, do they have a retirement system in the same way as Hong Kong, or in the same way as Japan, or have you got institutions of scale which are not sort of which are privately owned?
Yeah, no, it's a tricky one. I mean, that is a bit tricky. So the Chinese pension. The main one, the sort of the government one, is, you know, it's one of the biggest in the world, right? But it's a bit tricky, right, in terms of like what kind of investor in China may look favorably on ILS. You know, right now, you know the sovereign debt market pays 3% plus yields, right? It's minimum volatility, it's large, A+ rated, it's big and scalable sort of market. It's 90% held domestically, right? The sort of political risk or that sort of issue that maybe investors outside may have as perhaps a primary concern investing into sort of the Chinese domestic sort of fixed income type of thing is not really there for someone locally. I don't think they lack confidence for the sort of credit risks of the country. So. You know, there's no currency risk issues or hedging requirements. So as a sort of, you know, a complement or to a sort of a fixed income portfolio, I think a US dollar sort of collateralized cat bond is may not seem so attractive, especially the need, like I said before, for usage of quotas and credits. You know, it's the sort of additional yield that maybe, you know, there when you're a European or a Japanese investor, it just isn't sort of the same. And I think the other issue is always, you know, the correlation of, you know, not just Chinese issued debt, right? But also the equities and all of these are sort of shown a bit surprisingly that it's almost quite low correlation with almost all global assets historically, right? Which now, you know, the sort of the big one, right? The non-correlated benefit is perhaps a little less attractive comparatively.
Right.
So I think, or the other way, you're competing against everything now, right? So, I think there are some opportunities. I think there would be some interested. So, you know, perhaps more immediately, I guess institutions or investors which have a presence in Hong Kong, for example, it's not small. And perhaps they would be more favorable on the asset class. We've seen that, you know, the funds are already offshore. There's no sort of restrictions in place to invest in sort of foreign assets. And so it's just, you know, it's a bit more difficult maybe to target, or perhaps it's a bit more fragmented, but they are, that market is there. And I think, you know, we have seen that with some, you know, in insurers, especially life insurers that have that are from perhaps the mainland, but have a, say they have a captive or something in Hong Kong, or some presence in Hong Kong has shown some interest. Right. Like, there's less hurdles to invest. Hong Kong has, you know, currency that's pegged to the US dollar. And they've had more exposure, more opportunities, or they've been shown more sort of offshore opportunities and a wider range of investment opportunities. And again, you know, there's a lot of high net worth and family offices, like mentioned before, that have sort of set up offices in Hong Kong and Singapore, you know, favorable sort of tax regimes compared to mainland China. So a lot of that money is already out with, you know, some perhaps in Hong Kong, I said, for, you know, with some volatility and uncertainty and sort of traditional asset classes that they've looked at here in Hong Kong, you know, maybe there's interest there or opportunity there for sort of a, you know, a liquid non-correlating asset class right now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's interesting. So, I mean, you mentioned Hong Kong, and obviously Hong Kong now has its own sort of ILS regulatory regime that's established and has this connection to China and various agreements with China on investment flows. Do you think that the Hong Kong ILS platform may be exactly the stimulus that's required to sort of open China up to ILS a little bit more?
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely very important. I think it's sort of the whole intention, right? So I mean, the intention and the ambitions of Hong Kong to develop the local ILS hub is really, I don't think it's as investor focused. It's more to, you know, bring money to support the growth of the mainland. It's sort of, you know, Hong Kong's always tried to be successful, and they've been, you know, successful for decades, and sort of being that sort of bridge to sort of get foreign investments and stuff to sort of help the growth on the mainland and to sort of take advantage of those opportunities there. I think the local ILS regulatory regime, as it develops and provides more flexibility and different tools for seedings locally in the region, Greater China region or maybe beyond, this will probably coincide with the eventual need for capacity here. You know, Hong Kong would be a sort of a local, a logical destination for a local insurer or reinsurer to sort of maybe set up their own seed and sponsored ILS strategy out here, you know, similar to how you see in Bermuda, you know, that sort of thing. It makes sense to be sort of done here through Hong Kong. We see a lot of mainland Chinese insurance companies already have, you know, a captive presence here in Hong Kong for a long time already. That, you know, that closer to home presence, you know, they can take advantage of things like shared resources, you know, modeling capabilities, that sort of, those sort of benefits. And it's obviously, it's sort of easier to monitor, you remove sort of some of the more practical issues you may have with like time zone differences and language barriers. The city already has a big local talent pool, which is experienced with the local reinsurance market. I mean, all the major, I guess, reinsurance brokers that are responsible for the Greater China region are all headquartered in Hong Kong. Hong Kong's already always had sort of that track record of an existing infrastructure developed over, you know, decades of accessing, you know, global investors into the region. I mean, if you see outside my window right now, those buildings, actually it's the Hong Kong offices of like the Canadian Pension Plan and Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, for example. And so, you know, I think also that link between the city and the mainland means that sort of things can be more efficiently done out here. And so I think that sort of alignment of interest and comfort between, you know, the Hong Kong and the mainland and the central government is quite important. And I guess that makes sense, right? It's sort of what it's a special administrative region of China. Mm. So that's sort of the purpose of it. And so, yeah, no, so definitely, I think Hong Kong's ILS regime is very welcome and critical step for precedence here in Greater China to sort of embrace and develop that sort of capability in accessing, you know, global ILS investors and alternative capital, which they probably will need more in the future.
Yeah, no, it sounds like, I mean, you mentioned the Greater Bay Re structure that's been registered. So it does sound like Hong Kong could position itself as the conduit, both for capital and risk in either direction, which would be positive. And it's interesting you mentioned captives as well, as obviously that's another potential area of opportunity. If a Chinese insurer already has a captive based in Hong Kong, can they more easily or readily get that registered and authorized for ILS transactions at the same time, perhaps in the future? It seems there's a lot of potential there.
It's also more like if they want to send people from head office, for example, you know, the city is obviously a little less of a move.
Like sure.
Culture shock or whatever. So it just makes a lot of sense, I think.
Yes, and the whole Greater Bay Area region is just phenomenal in terms of growth, population, exposure as a result. And insurance penetration is still lagging behind, I guess, what we would expect in the West. But there's just so much growth to come from there. And as a result, there will be a need for capacity to support that, you would imagine. So I guess as we wrap this up, perhaps you could give our viewers a bit of a prediction. So where would you expect the Asian ILS investor landscape to be in, say, a decade from now? Do you think we'll have expanded it, or are we going to be still looking at the core locations and the core pensions who are the allocators today in the region?
I think it's 10 years from now. I think what will happen, I think what I hope will happen, put it that way. I think between Hong Kong and Singapore, you know, if they manage to have that, right, like that sort of hub, and you'll see maybe, you know, in Asia, reinsurer, there's a lot of big ones, right? And they start to have that, they sort of develop out that presence or that sort of capability, and then they put it within, say, Hong Kong or Singapore, and maybe a lot of the Greater China ones will be in Hong Kong, and maybe a Korean one decides to go to, I don't know, Singapore or something like that, right? And that sort of, hopefully that sort of kicks it off. And I think that sort of development, right, just that wider sort of community, that sort of service provider community relating to the asset class, you know, that will sort of grow alongside in parallel to the sort of local community, local investor community and contribution. You know, just that larger presence makes a big difference, I think, and having more reach, they start to develop sort of local relationships with new investors and people are more exposed to the asset class and people they know and that sort of thing. And so I think sort of as that talent pool develops, I think naturally the investors will also naturally come sort of in parallel with that. And then, you know, once that happens, I think maybe you'll see, hopefully, more longer term, perhaps, and similar to perhaps Bermuda, you know, track records start to be developed, you know, those investor relationships are sort of gained within the region. You know, those different relationships from different cedents are sort of built up. And then sort of maybe you'll start seeing more, you know, independent ILS strategies as well coming out of Hong Kong and Singapore. Everything I think is sort of there for it. Infrastructure is there, you know, both in Hong Kong and Singapore. Mm. So I guess fingers crossed, you know, it's yes. A bit lonely here as the only one right now. So.
But you've been blazing the trail for quite a while now. So I guess it's
been tough,
time.
Right? We can't travel. Like, we can't, like, go too far right now. Like, yeah, you guys in, I guess, in the UK or the US, you know, if you want to go somewhere, you guys have multiple places to go. And for me, a big trip is across the harbor to Kowloon, which is about 15 minutes away.
So. Sure. I guess one final question. Do you think in 10 years or so from now, we'll have enough sort of Chinese risk or local risk in the market as well, that we might need to see locally denominated issuances to really get investor appetite rising around there as well?
No, I think there's two parts of that, right? So yes, I think the idea of that is actually quite good, because, you know, if it's in the Chinese currency, it's invested in sort of, you have that sort of added yield you can earn. The Chinese currency is, I can't imagine it being devalued at this time, right? So I think the currency risk is minimal. Even if you wanted to hedge it, it's not a lot. So I think that's sort of if it was like collateralized in locally and invested in those sort of things, I think that would be something, you know, for us, that would be something interesting, just because, you know, the margin then becomes quite a bit higher. And we see some of the, you know, the Japanese cap ones, right? The spreads are quite low. And so, you know, if you're talking, you know, minimum rate on lines out here are in that area as well, right? And so that added yield means that much more, right, percentage wise. And so I think that's quite important. But also, I think for, if you're trying to get investors locally, right, that helps as well. They don't have to from the mainland. I don't know if that's the intention, but you know, it's an investment that's closer to home. It's supporting, you know, it's an important thing out here, right? Like supporting the country always has sort of benefits to it. So yeah, I think that's something that could help. But no, in terms of eventually, I think these, you know, China will have the need for ILS capacity. There's also other things, right? Like, you know, the Belt and Road project, right? That's just massive. Like, it's the biggest probably infrastructure project in history, right? And you know, that sort of new Silk Road or whatever they're trying to build, you know, when they're thinking of, you know, the routes and where that's supposed to go, I don't think, you know, they're thinking about, you know, ILS or avoiding natural catastrophes per se. So I think there's, you know, that's an opportunity for out of the mainland for ILS. Also, you know, the central government made a pretty big announcement saying that, you know, they plan to be sort of carbon neutral by 2060. I think there's opportunities out of there. I think, you know, 10 years from now, maybe a little bit more. That sort of time, there's quite a lot of opportunity out there. But also, I think, you know, the thing people may overlook or cannot consider is, you know, a lot of the big reinsurers out here, and some of them are, you know, some of the biggest in the world, right? All across Asia, not just mainland China, but they also have diversified their portfolio as well, right? They write large, you know, international books of business as well. Yeah. And so, you know, they also face that sort of, you know, their retro costs or retrocession costs are face the same sort of issues eventually that other global reinsurance companies face as well. And so I think if they have the ability to sort of package, you know, some of the stuff they can explain as, you know, they have better access to within their sort of home sort of territory, you mix that in with sort of perils that perhaps ILS investors are already better understood or more comfortable with, then maybe that's quite compelling and can also be, you know, have cedents out here start to take advantage of offerings there from ILS managers.
No, it's very interesting. Thank you, Tim. I'm going to draw this to a close now. That was a really good discussion, and I think I learned a lot about the region, which after 5 or 6 years of running a conference there is saying something, so I hope our audience enjoyed it too. So I'll just say thank you again, Tim. Really appreciate it, and look forward to catching up with you soon.
Thank you, Steve. Hopefully next year we'll be here.
Somewhere in person would be nice. Anywhere, yes. Anywhere in person would be nice. Thanks, Tim.
No,
bye.
No, thanks, Steve. Cheers.